to anyone observing that, occasionally it would look as if she had just literally gone to sleep. She literally laid down.
The Alaska Sea Life Center tries to make sense of the death of a popular animal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 21st of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a fire devastates a restaurant and lodge in Elfin Cove.
I've been here 30 years and seen three fires, and that's the worst I've ever seen here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Governor Sean Parnell signed five education-related bills into law in Fairbanks today. One of the bills authorizes the state to bond for $397 million in K-12 schools and University of Alaska infrastructure projects. Working the Fairbanks crowd, Parnell highlighted the package's biggest ticket item, a long-sought-after building at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Most notably, for those of you here, UAF Life Sciences building is in this piece of legislation. Hello.
The bond package includes $88 million for the life sciences facility. University Board of Regents member Eric Drygass of Fairbanks welcomed its signing.
It's been a long process. It's been, 4 or 5 years through a lot of regents, and a lot of hard work has gone into it. To finally see it go to the voters is important for the university and not only university, but Fairbanks and the state.
Drygass says the life science department is out of room, and a new facility will not only expand education and research, but the opportunity to secure major grant funding. Governor Parnell said the bond package, which also includes $60 million for a new athletic facility for the University of Alaska Anchorage and rural school construction, is statewide in scope and worth what it will cost Alaska.
If the financing is accomplished with the Build America bonds, that means roughly about a $30 million annual payment from the state. So that's the financial obligation with the educational opportunity that's presented here.
Another piece of legislation penned into law extends the state's 70-30 state-to-local school construction cost reimbursement program and makes a similar formula available to unorganized areas. Bill sponsor Fairbanks Senator Joe Thomas says it opens up opportunity for smaller communities.
Of course, they will have to raise funds, obviously through primarily donations, but at least they will be able to get some financing and more reimbursement for the local area.
Thomas points to donations from Native corporations as a potential funding source for communities that want to take advantage of the 70-30 program. The final education bill signed by the governor dovetails into that opportunity. It increases the state tax credit for private companies that donate to accredited schools to $5 million. The Alaska Sea Life Center is mourning the death of a 17-year-old sea lion named Kiska and her unborn pup. The pair died late Friday. Until then, Kiska's pregnancy had been worry-free, and the center was eagerly anticipating the arrival of her pup. It would have been the first captive birth of a Steller sea lion in the U.S. in 2 decades. APRN's Any Fight reports.
Staff at the Sea Life Center had been monitoring Kiska 24/7 for the last month, expecting her to give birth any day. On Friday night, the director of husbandry, Brett Long, was watching Kiska's webcam feed when he noticed her activity increase, a sign of labor. He drove to the center to check on her, but by the time he arrived, Kiska was dead. Ian Dutton is president and CEO of the Sea Life Center. He says the webcam feed doesn't offer any clues.
To anyone observing that, occasionally it would look as if she had just literally gone to sleep. She literally laid down. And so there was nothing, obviously, even a mortality event occurring. It was just really something that we'll go back and we'll keep looking at that, trying to understand. But clearly that's why we've now got the necropsy process underway and trying to understand biologically just what happened in that event.
A necropsy Sunday didn't reveal any obvious cause of death. In the next few weeks, tissue and microbiology samples will be analyzed to try to figure out what happened. Dutton says Kiska was in prime condition to be a parent.
And that's the confounding thing. This is very much like one of those hard-to-explain human pregnancies that just went wrong as well, but we just really need to understand now from the tissue analysis what might have been the underlying factor, or if there was an underlying factor, because everything up to that point, and literally to the point where she passed away, had been normal.
Kiska had been at the Sea Life Center since it opened in 1998. Dutton says for staff there, her death is like losing a member of their family.
Staff here understood the risks and they were prepared for them. But when something like this actually happens, you know, it's hard to be prepared emotionally for something like this.
Kiska's pregnancy was part of a long-term study to figure out why the wild Steller sea lion population has declined steadily since the 1970s. Biologists were hoping to look at how costly it is for female sea lions to go through a pregnancy and maintain a pup. Dutton doesn't expect Kiska's death to put an end to that research. Biologists were hoping to continue the breeding program this summer. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
An Elfin Cove Lodge restaurant and another building were destroyed by fire over the weekend.
The worst fire I think Elfin Cove's ever had that I know of. I've been here 30 years and seen three fires, and that's the worst I've ever seen here.
Jim Wild says he was awakened just before 2 a.m. Saturday by Coho restaurant owner Shirley Perkins, who saw flames pouring out of the Cove Lodge.
It was shortly after that we got the fire siren going.
Wild and his wife, Mary Jo, were among the 4,250 people who initially responded to the fire. He says Cove Lodge and a separate crew quarters were quickly involved. Coho Restaurant and Bar were just a few feet away.
I mean, it's close. It's like 10 feet away, you know. And in the meantime, the fire jumped from the lower building of the Cove Lodge up to his upper building, which is located uphill from it. So at that point, both buildings were burning and there were flames 100 feet in the air.
A state fire marshal is investigating the cause of the fire. Elfin Cove is about 85 miles west of Juneau on the north shore of Chichagof Island. Its permanent population is about 25. Wild estimates there are about 75 in town this summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the challenge of going from a small native community to a big city college.
I had difficulty with, you know, like the food. It was totally different. I didn't have the right clothes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A helicopter crashed on Unalaska Island on Saturday evening, leaving the pilot dead. Lonnie Kennedy, 48, had just dropped off two passengers and was attempting to take off from Chernofsky Point when the helicopter skid caught the ground, causing the helicopter to roll over. A call reporting the accident was made from the Fort Glenn Cattle Ranch on Umnak Island, where Kennedy lived and worked, at approximately 6 p.m. The Coast Guard District 17 Command Center dispatched a response team, which arrived at 8:27 p.m. Captain Gary Gray, an Unalaska Public Safety EMT, confirmed that the pilot was deceased. The two witnesses had already departed the area on board another ranch helicopter. Next of kin have been notified, according to State Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters. Trooper Daniel Blizzard is leading the body recovery effort.
My concern as the troopers and the family's concern, obviously, is to get the remains back to the family, you know, and, you know, we tried to get out there last night, but the weather was just too bad. So, you know, obviously we're trying to get out there now and get this taken care of as soon as possible.
Kennedy was originally from Arizona, where his wife and younger children are at present. Kennedy regularly traveled from Umnak Island to Unalaska Island to pick up supplies and to work on the cattle ranch at Chernofsky Point. Commercial salmon fisheries opened over the weekend in northern southeast Alaska. State biologists are forecasting weak to average returns for the region, which has been the recent trend in even years. But as KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, fishermen should continue to benefit from a trend toward higher prices.
2004 was a strange year in southeast, according to Alaska Department of Fish and Game Juneau Area Commercial Fisheries Manager Kevin Monagle.
2004, we had what some people are calling that drought summer. Incredibly dry summer, very prolonged, very little rain. And what we saw from that is those fish couldn't enter freshwater. They held at stream mouths for weeks, if not months. And obviously, the spawning success was very poor.
That triggered a trend, good to average returns in odd years, average to poor returns in even years. Monagle says 2008 was one of the worst seasons on record for pink salmon, the bread and butter fish of southeast Saners. It's 2 years later, and he expects more of the same. The 2010 forecast calls for a commercial pink salmon harvest in southeast of about 19 million fish, less than half the recent 10-year average of 40 million pinks.
And primarily, northern southeast Alaska is really where the holes are.
The state doesn't have an official forecast for northern southeast sockeye, which spawn up the Taku and Chilkat rivers in Canada. Monagle says Canadian officials estimate about 200,000 reds will reach Alaska this summer, slightly below average. Southeast fishermen generally catch sockeye while targeting hatchery chum, which Monagle says is one of the few relatively bright spots this year.
The one attraction for the Saners on the north end is the Hidden Falls chum salmon fishery. That does attract a lot of effort. The price of those fish is as high as we've seen it. There's huge value in those fish. And in Hidden Falls, they had a couple years of weaker returns than normal, but the last couple years they've been getting back into their, I would say, their average zone.
The Hidden Falls hatchery on the Chatham Strait side of Baranoff Island is operated by the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association in Sitka. Ensurah and Douglas Island Pink and Chum in Juneau produce most of the dog salmon harvested by the Southeast Fleet. About 1.6 million chum are expected to return to Hidden Falls this summer. DIPAC Executive Director Eric Prestigard expects a return this year of about 2.1 million chum in Lynn Canal and Taku Inlet combined. After higher returns in 2008 and 2009, he says that's closer to the long-term average. But Prestigard admits you never really know.
We guess and guess and guess, and when the season's over, it's when we really know.
One thing that bodes well for fishermen is the recent price of hatchery chum, which has been on the rise since the early 2000s. According to the McDowell Group, the dock value of DIPAC salmon in 2001 was $2.6 million. By 2008, that number was $9.9 million. Prestigard says the big factor wasn't more fish, but that the fish were worth more.
8 years ago, the price for chum salmon was down around 15 cents a pound, and it's probably going to be up, this year, probably 65 to 70 cents a pound on the grounds. That's a phenomenal increase.
Prestigard says better marketing, along with processing and quality improvements, are responsible for the price increase. It remains to be seen how many boats participate in this year's northern southeast commercial salmon fisheries. Fish and Game's Monagle says the number of gill netters can range from 40 to 50 boats to 100 or more at the peak of the season. He says a few southeast Saners might test the northern waters, but if they don't find any pink salmon, they may spend most of their time down south. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Kuskokwim River king salmon have always been prized for their nutritional value, but this year a really big king could land a lucky fisherman some valuable fuel. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more on this year's Kuskokwim King Fishing Derby.
The Derby marks the first fishing contest in recent memory on the Kuskokwim. It's being hosted by Crowley Fuel Services and run by their Bethel manager, Brandon Larry.
I remember as a kid growing up here, the First National used to always do a king salmon competition, and I said, oh, that'd be kind of fun this time of year. So that's what we decided to do, and we put something together. They okayed it, so Here we are.
Crowley is awarding 5 top prizes.
Heaviest fish wins.
And you don't need a fishing pole to compete.
Pretty simple. Fish can be caught any legal means, set net, drift, rod and reel, as long as it's on the Kuskokwim and any of the tributaries. You got to be fairly fresh fish. Can't be sitting in the freezer for a couple of days or laying around.
Once the king has been weighed, fishers are free to take it home to be cut up for their freezer or smokehouse. But if the scale tips a little too generously, Leary says the judges will be the ones doing the cutting.
We do reserve the right to any suspect fish to cut them open and look. Because I remember when I used to run fish tenders here, people used to stuff them kings with shotgun shells and lead weights and whatever they could get in there.
And since subsistence fishers will be wanting to get that fish cared for quickly, Crowley is also providing a hotline for off-hour catches, with a caveat.
No 2 a.m. calls unless it's a real monster.
Kuskokwim fishermen have until this Friday to submit their kings. The heaviest fish so far is 43 pounds. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The State Department of Health is reporting another suspected case of paralytic shellfish poisoning in Alaska, the 5th in the past 2 weeks. A Haines man developed symptoms of PSP after eating the viscera, or internal organs, of Dungeness crab Friday night. He was medevaced to Juneau Saturday and released from Bartlett Regional Hospital this morning. PSP is not normally found in crab meat, but can be found in the viscera. The State Department of Health warns people not to consume internal organs from subsistence or recreationally harvested crabs. PSP can occur any time of year. Symptoms include numbness or tingling of the face, arms, and legs, headache, dizziness, and nausea. The State Department of Environmental Conservation plans to test crab from Chilcat Inlet, where the crab was caught. A Juneau woman died last week from what officials think was PSP. 3 cases were also reported in Kodiak, though there were no deaths.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Sea Alaska Corporation has purchased the so-called Pit in the center of downtown Juneau for a Southeast Alaska Native Cultural and Visitor Center.
The hole was a problem, but the plywood fence, that just went over the edge.
Sea Alaska Executive Vice President Rick Harris admits he feels like a lot of Capital City residents who are tired of looking at the vacant lot on the corner of Front and Seward Streets. It was once the site of the Juneau Town Center, destroyed by fire in 2004. Also known as the Skinner and Endicott Building, the wooden structure on pilings was 108 years old when it burned. Sea Alaska headquarters are across the street. Harris says the sale is contingent on some preliminary work, including rebuilding the crumbling sidewalk. Loads of dirt are already being spread.
Part of the conditions of the purchase is that the site be filled and corrective action be made on the sidewalk. When that's complete, we will make the final payment. And at that point in time, we will do some general landscaping there so that it looks like something more than a vacant lot. And there will be a sign posted there saying it will be the future home of the Archival and Cultural Center.
Once the sale is complete, Sea Alaska Corporation will turn the property over to the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, the corporation's nonprofit cultural and educational foundation. SHI will develop the center. Several years ago, the corporation approached owners Hugh Grant and Thomas Huntington about purchasing the lot, but couldn't reach agreement. Earlier this year, Tlingit and Haida Central Council former president Bill Martin proposed buying it for a cultural center, but the council rejected the idea.
The property owner really just decided that it was time, in fact, to sell it. And they came back to us after the Central Council transaction wasn't successful and asked us if we remained interested, and we told them that we were, and were able to move forward and consummate the purchase.
In March, a leadership citizens group formed called Fix the Pit, asking CBJ Assembly to find a solution. The group even started a Fix the Pit Facebook page, which got hundreds of hits. Ellen Walker was getting out of her car Friday in front of the pit just after the announcement that SeaAlaska was buying it.
I'm part of the Fix the Pit crowd on Facebook. I'm really so glad they're doing this.
$2 million are in the 2010 state capital budget to be used for project planning. The Heritage Institute has already started fundraising for the facility, estimated to cost about $16 million. Jacqueline Johnson-Peta runs one of the most prominent Native American organizations in the country from Washington, D.C., but her roots are in Alaska. As the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, she advocates for a range of issues, including education. As part of our periodic series about Alaska Natives and education, Peta sat down with APRN's Libby Casey to reflect on her own education and what it has meant to her.
Jackie Johnson-Peta is Tlingit of the Raven Tribe and went through the Juneau school system. Education was always important to her.
I thought I was a pretty darn good student. I don't know if my teachers will say that, but I thought I was very excited about education. And, you know, I loved finding solutions. I loved to read. And so I felt like I had enough academic abilities, you know, to be able to succeed.
But that didn't necessarily translate into success at college. Peta initially went to a small campus in Utah.
You know, small Juneau, small college. But it was a big transition for me, and it was a difficult time for me. I ended up transferring to a larger school. I went to Utah State, which was much larger at the time than even the city of Juneau was. And I quickly fell out of sorts.
When Peta was in school, she got good grades, but it was a hard transition, being so far away from her culture and roots.
I had difficulty with, you know, like the food. It was totally different. I didn't have the right clothes, you know, all those kinds of things that bear on a young woman's mind when you go out there.
She ended up dropping out and instead got married and raised children and then returned to school in hopes of building her career.
I went back to school again, got exceptional grades, but I didn't have the resources to be able to sustain going to school. And so I had to come back home and get a job and support my family.
That means Peta, who now runs a successful and prominent national organization, who sits on the board of the SeaAlaska Native Corporation and is a proud grandmother, never finished college.
I've always felt totally embarrassed that I've never graduated from college. But on the other hand, I know that I've supplemented all those educational, you know, academic requirements by real life experiences and the things that I've pursued in my education. And I think that's really important.
Peta says what stopped her is what stops many Alaska Natives, money.
You know, resources being tight for many Alaska Native students. I think there's a lot of Alaska Natives who probably have somewhat the same story that I have, with a real desire.
But it's not just about money, Peta says. It's about being welcomed in schools and feeling like you belong. She says despite many warm and attentive teachers, Alaska Native ways of life and traditions weren't usually reflected in school.
Alaska Native culture was just wasn't talked about, except for in art class. And I remember in high school, I got to take carving class. And so all the Native students took carving. And we were all in there and we just loved it. And that was like a really important thing to us. But other than in our carving class, it just wasn't there.
Even though Peta didn't finish college, education has a strong place in her life. She's a self-described bookworm and has always turned to the written word to learn. She's continued to take classes in things like speech writing and computer software. And instead of being intimidated by people with college degrees, she sets her own goals and fights to meet them.
Every year I did a self-assessment. I decided what was going to be important, what are the things that I needed to learn to be able to do my job, what was I weak at, and what did I need to strengthen. And then I would expose myself to the things that were my weaknesses.
Peta says her advice, don't be afraid of learning.
Even though I said earlier, I'm embarrassed that I never graduated, I was never embarrassed to go and to learn or to ask questions. I always laugh, and even to my staff, I always say I'm the self-help queen. I've read probably everything that I could learn to read about on, you know, reengineering a corporation, or, you know, giving a speech, or, you know, how do women think? I think it's really important to be able to say, you know, I'm pursuing my education. It's in a different way, but it makes sense for me, and I'm doing it. I'm conscientiously pursuing my education.
And someday, maybe when she retires from running the National Congress of American Indians, Jackie Peta wants to go back to school and finish her degree. Then she'd like to become a college professor teaching others. Tomorrow, Peta will share her and her organization's solutions for improving Native education. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Angoon's tribal government is challenging the state's role in subsistence management. The Southeast Alaska Village's action comes as four of its residents prepare to go on trial for allegedly overfishing their subsistence permits. The Angoon Community Association sent a letter this month to Sitka's regional office of the State Department of Fish and Game. It says the state should defer to tribes. Elder Edward Gamble, speaking at a recent tribal summit, objected to requirements that village residents obtain state permits.
Subsistence is not a fishery for the state to manage, but an inherent customary and traditional right of indigenous people of Southeast Alaska.
The tribal government also opposes state management on Admiralty Island, where Angoon is located, because it's a national monument under federal jurisdiction. Gamble says the community association also objects to the permit application process.
They make you sign a piece of paper that has all the conditions on there. And looking at that, to me and to the council, that's entrapment. They take you to court for signing the piece of paper on something that is your inherent right.
The letter was sent to Bill Davidson in Fish and Game's Sitka office in response to a press release about subsistence permits. Davidson says he and other officials could not comment because of an upcoming court case, but the state has defended its management practices in the past, saying it is required by state law. State Senator Albert Kukesh and three other Angoon residents go on trial July 8th. They are charged with catching more sockeye salmon in a beach seine last summer than their subsistence permits allowed. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of our stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemary Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ed Schoenfeld in Angoon. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.